Over 15 years ago now, I sat down to make a list of dream participants for what would become the Chasing Earhart project. I came up with a list of 25 names, and on that list was a man who's been associated with the search for Amelia Earhart since the first deep ocean expedition for her took place in 1999. In fact, he's the man who led that search almost 25 years ago. In that time, every search that's included the Pacific Ocean near Howland has come calling, requesting consultation on their efforts in a potential discovery of the Holy Grail of aviation. He's a pilot, navigator, sailor, and adventurer, and he's a giant in the story of the search for two missing aviators lost to history. Welcome back to Chasing Earhart. From Mission Bay, San Diego, this is Dana Timmer. Dana, welcome back to the show. It's always an honor. I appreciate you, sir.
Thank you very much. I just arrived back from a sail delivery up the Mexican coast, so timing is good. And it was a rough trip. It really slammed around going upwind. And anyway, safely arrived in Mission Bay.
There you go. Safe travels. Probably the coolest life of anybody that's ever guested on the show. We'll get to a lot. Lots to discuss tonight. We now have two potential wreck sites, one out at Buca, which we'll get to here in a bit. But now we have something unfolding out near Howland that is very much in your wheelhouse. I know you've consulted with Tony Romeo and Deep Sea Vision on their potential findings. They consider your opinion extremely valuable. I certainly hold you in the highest regard. Let me ask you bluntly, is this Amelia Earhart's Electra?
No way to tell, really, at this point until, get some good imaging. You know, there's some interesting features, and I guess size kind of matches up. And I know the Williamson people did some, there's a thing called a flashlight test. Mm-hmm. You know, it could be the airplane, and that's according to some of the people at Williamson. What's concerning to me in particular is the lack of any engines. That should be the hardest return, the most visible parts of the airplane, and we're not seeing any engines. So, I know Tony's planning on going back out and just have to, reserve judgment until, they get a better image.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. Let me just ask you, if you're in charge of this mission and you've just confirmed the location of Earhart's Electra, what needs to happen to ensure that there's no compromising the wreck site and that what's recovered can be properly preserved?
Well, I think the first mission out there is certainly either a high resolution sonar image. That the Huygens has incredible capabilities, and there should be a really sharp image of that object. Mm-hmm. The camera wasn't working apparently as well. So
yeah,
they should get, this the sharpest image you can imagine, with their capabilities.
Yeah,
that would be the next mission solely if I were in charge. No touching of anything, just a lot of photographs. You can hover right over the plane and almost look in the window. That would be the next mission. You know, I've been doing this for so long. Back when we did our search, there was nowhere near, I think, the amount of regulations. What is it now? Howland is in a park?
Yeah, I think so. I know you and I have talked about that offline quite a bit. We'll definitely get to that.
I was speaking with Dave, and they're more in tune with all that. There's a lot of bureaucracy that would need to be addressed.
A lot of red tape.
These days. Not so much when we did the search in 1999.
Yeah.
But anyway, there's that whole aspect of negotiating with governmental authorities. But as far as the actual mission, it would be purely photography for maybe several over some months. They'd see something in the first round. And anyway, a lot of in situ observing and photographing and planning on how, I think everybody is an agreement that, recovering it, then there's a big preservation process.
Yeah.
In addition to the recovery, it has to go right back in a tank of water.
Yeah.
The plane and everything in it. Mm. But they've done an amazing job with Titanic artifacts and others.
Yeah.
In London, there's a wooden warship, bows and all that, in the mud, and they recovered all of that. So
yeah.
This plane will be able to be meticulously preserved, and the objects, the paper documents, everything that's in the airplane. You know, there won't be any human remains in the airplane.
Yeah.
The salt water would have eaten away any remains. So in any case, and then plan a recovery and a preservation. You know, the first port of call should be Honolulu, I think, as far as you need a barge and a crane and, you know, and ROVs and, you know, it's a substantial recovery operation.
Yeah.
Not unprecedented. U.S., I believe, Navy recovered a helicopter. This is years ago from about the same depths.
Mm.
So there is experience in these really ultra deep water recoveries.
Yeah. People that are going to be listening to this are certainly interested in this. I wonder if you could just, you've touched on it a little bit tonight. I wonder if you could just speak to the difficulty in pulling off, you know, a deep ocean search to begin with. I mean, what goes into these expeditions? It's really incredible. You were the first to do it. What are we dealing with out here, specifically near Howland? Can you speak to that? I know you can.
Well, the remoteness is a big factor.
Yeah.
We mobilized out of Majuro in the Marshall Islands, which is, I think, about 600 miles. Tarawa is closer by a bit. I haven't been out there in some years now, but just the logistics, you know, getting the team. Obviously, the team is key. Of course, the equipment.
Yeah.
It's all autonomous. We used the towed system when we did our search. Williamson had, you know, very good luck and experience with their sonar, deep water sonar, and so we use that. You know, it's harder to operate that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the AUVs, you just drop over the side and then they do their thing. And then you pick it up and pull it out of the water, recharge it and pull the data from it.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, making turns with 6,000 meters of cable out behind the boat is, you know, time consuming. So, yeah, team equipment, a good platform, the ship you're going to use needs some endurance and carry enough food. You know, there's probably whatever, 20 people on board between the ship and the sonar team and whoever else. So those are the key factors.
Yeah.
Tony was out for a long time on site.
Yeah. Obviously, I won't certainly ask you to get into private conversation between you and Tony, but I do know that you were consulted on this most recent potential find. Is there anything about that conversation that you're willing to share publicly? What did you guys talk about? What kind of questions were they asking you? Can you sort of give us a peek at that?
It started off through Dave Jordan. They had contacted Dave while they were still out on site.
Sure.
Wondered if he had any targets Dave wanted checked out. He didn't, but we do have two targets the Williamson team has identified as worthy of having a look. It looks like the wing would be detached. There's no way of knowing if they remained intact or
you
know, the wing came off or whatever.
It's all on the table. Yeah.
Anyway, so we started a conversation about these targets. Tony's response when I sent him the targets without the, you know, lat long, but sent him the target, he said, well, that's not an intact Electra. And I said, maybe that's, you shouldn't be looking, you know, I mean, you got to keep an open mind about what you're looking for. And so that's where it started. So about targets. And then that was it. They just chose not to look at our targets. I was contacted by the Wall Street Journal. You know, that was the first article. They released the story first.
Sure.
Tony's story. I was asked a few questions for that story. And so that was the next round. And then what else? Just discussed their target, I think, during one of our conversations. And I don't know. Do you have... I don't have any contact with Purdue.
Yeah, I do have a little bit of contact with Purdue. I haven't talked to Purdue at length about anything that's going on. I'm sure they know.
Yeah.
You know, famously on Vanished, when we did that series on Earhart, I remember Mitch Daniels saying, it's, you know, the plane, it's our plane, belongs to us. If it's ever found, it's our plane. I don't know if that was the opinion of one man and not the position of the university, but if it's the position of the university, as you alluded to earlier in the conversation, we're going to have a mighty interesting situation unfolding on our hands if Tony's right.
Well, Central America is, that went all the way to the Supreme Court. Ship of Gold and Deep Blue Sea, great book. And it's about Williamson found under contract the Central America, which is the Ship of Gold and the Deep Blue Sea. Yeah, certainly rights to ownership become important. You know, that was $300 million worth of gold. Tommy Thompson was the lead of that project. And as soon as they found that, this is 1988, everybody and their brother came and said, thanks for finding our gold. the insurance companies. There were 13 of them, I think, you know, Lloyd's being one of them. And
yeah.
Some monks and some, you know.
I can only imagine what this is going to be like when this happens. I mean, if he's right, I can only imagine.
Well, I started doing this in the early 90s, and I said, you know, if I find this airplane, I certainly don't want to go through that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got a copy of Amelia's will and then started talking with Amy Kleppner,
right?
Wonderful lady.
Yes.
And a lot of years of discussing Amelia and so forth. Anyway, I got an agreement in place.
Mm-hmm.
I think in regards to Purdue, their own documents in their collection, they have the collection of Amelia Earhart documents, memorabilia.
Mm-hmm.
Their own documents clearly state Purdue was giving the airplane to Amelia.
Right.
The airplane was registered in Amelia's name. It belonged to Amelia.
That's right.
Bendix and a few other wealthy donors had provided, I think it was only $40,000 to buy the, I shouldn't say only because it's 1936, but it was $40,000 to buy the airplane.
Yeah.
Purdue's own documents clearly show that they gave it as a gift to Amelia, not Amelia and George, but specifically to Amelia.
Sure.
And it was registered solely in her name, not insured like the Central America situation.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't insure that airplane in that world flight, which is interesting.
It's telling because that tells me that she didn't plan on losing the aircraft in the world flight, certainly.
Right. But then there's reasons why you have insurance. So,
right.
You know, you hit somebody's cow on a runway somewhere. Then,
yeah.
Any case, I'm sure there'll be lots of discussions, as you said, the various issues of this ownership issue.
I have to ask you, because if I don't ask you, the audience is going to crucify me for not asking you. Just a few minutes ago, you said you spoke with Amy Kleppner and you kind of dropped a little aside. You have an agreement in place. Are you saying you have an agreement in place in the event that the plane is found, or if you find it, how does that work? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well,
I don't want to push you. I'm just curious. Obviously, my listeners are going to be like, wait, what did he say? So got to ask.
Yeah, I mean, it's well known that, you know, Elgin, Dave Jordan, it's been clear that I've had this agreement in place with Amy. I haven't spoken for some time with Amy. In any case, we have an agreement. George Putnam died before Amy's mother. Amelia's whole side of things, the way her will is written, is that it would have gone to her mother instead of George.
Yeah.
As far as all of her worldly possessions, the plane being one of them. So it passed down from Amelia's mother, then, you know, Amelia's sister, and then Amy, you know, is in charge of all this. So
yeah,
it's been in place for some 20 years before our expedition.
Wow.
Well, like I said, I wanted to avoid any kind of, you know.
You saw it coming. You saw it coming and you wanted to make sure you took care of it.
Right. And even if you have all the documents in the world in place, you know, that's the way the world is, especially these days, just in business in general.
Well, that's called due diligence, ladies and gentlemen, if you're listening to this. So take a lesson from Dana here and do it right. That's interesting. I didn't know that. And I guess on that topic, well, maybe kind of off topic a little bit, because we have been talking about collaboration a lot on this show. I have been begging for collaboration since I've gotten into this thing, and I haven't been in it that long. What are your thoughts, though, on the collaboration that's going on right now? We've never had this level before. Do you think that's changing the landscape of the case as a whole? And is it good for a definitive resolution to have this kind of collaboration?
Yeah, I think so. You know, you're absolutely right. There has never been this level. I'm talking with Dave Jordan. We haven't spoken a little bit, but one thing that's clear is that if you look at a mosaic of the areas covered around Howland Island, as far as the sonar coverage, and I don't know where Tony was, but he covered a lot of area. We're running out of space to look. You know, there's not very many uncovered areas left.
Sure.
Certainly
sure.
To the east of Howland, there's a lot of area out there. You know, that would be her flying past the island. I don't see that happening myself. It is still a possibility. Mm. She flew to the north and ended up to the east of the island. Any case, the collaboration, well, there's a tool. Tony has the perfect tool for doing this. Need a platform, you know, need a boat with some endurance.
Yeah.
And of course, money is.
And ideas, some theory.
Yeah.
Let's throw some theory in there. Let's do that.
The theory part is, I don't know, between Dave Jordan and myself and Williamson and Elgin and Roy Ned. there's a lot of theory.
Yeah, plenty of that to go around, I'm sure.
Yeah. So it's more covering the remaining area.
Yeah.
That'd be great to see where Tony has been out there to see. They were working on this, at least I kept reading about the dateline theory, which it's not a factor because Fred Noonan was on Greenwich Mean Time and that dateline didn't mean anything. He'd have to be navigating his way from Ley, New Guinea, celestial navigation on local time, which would be really not smart. Mm-hmm. And that's not the way it's done. Keep knowing what time zone you're in to be able to take your star sight instead of the simple way of just using Greenwich Mean Time where you don't have to make any corrections.
Yeah.
Local time. So
I'll send you, I don't know if you've listened to Liz Smith's, the conversation I have with Liz, but I'll send you that conversation after we get off this call and have a listen. Okay. Let me know what you think.
All right.
Yeah, let's do that. You know, I've asked this question recently, but I think it'll hold special meaning for you. So I just want to give you the floor to answer it. Hypothetically speaking, let's say everyone strikes out here and we're back to square one with this. Maybe it's just not solvable. After all the work you've done over decades on this case, can this story end with no period on the sentence? Can you be okay with never knowing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, me being okay. Yeah. It's possible it won't be found. You know, it's a big ocean.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's certainly possible that there is no ending to the story. And, you know, I think at some point, the area around Howland is going to be covered. So that's, you know, and obviously, I believe strongly, as you know, Dave Jordan and Elgin and a lot of people believe strongly that that's where the airplane ended up.
Yeah.
Once you run out of room there, you know, and the plane is not found around Howland, then I think the plane will not be found. I don't believe it's in these other scenarios.
Okay. Well, that's my perfect cue to move 1,700 miles away from Howland Island and talk about the other wreck site that we have in this case. Now, you and I have discussed Buka offline and off the record several times, but we've never discussed it publicly. Let's remove the distance. We'll get to that in a bit. The mere presence of this aircraft really scares the shit out of me, Dana, because of the ramifications that, you know, it potentially holds out there. I just want to give you the floor. I know you don't feel this is it or that this is her aircraft, but I want to remove the distance and just talk about it from just an aeronautical standpoint, an underwater standpoint, just a recovery standpoint. It's wrapped in 4.5 feet of coral. This is not the same nautical environment that we're talking about out at Howland. We're talking at about 100 feet. I've seen the 8K footage, the ROV footage of the wreck site. It's stunning. It's gorgeous. And I just want to give you the floor to talk about your thoughts on Buka. Tell me why it's not possible. Let's start with that. And then just give me your thoughts on the wreck site and what's been reported in the news.
Well, I think we talked about this before. You know, the radio signals and their strength with the Itasca, it's really the only hard evidence other than those earlier two earlier radio transmissions Amelia made after departing Ley over the guard ship. She was heard twice.
She was heard twice, right.
This is prior to the Itasca radios.
Yeah, so prior to attempt, yes.
For Amelia to say what she was saying, she'd be on you, cannot see you, gas is running low. You know, she wouldn't be saying that 1,700 miles away.
Right.
Fred was an excellent navigator. They were off by just a little bit, not a lot, as far as the air and navigation. They were short, quite sure of it. Even a 10-mile error, they would not have seen Howland.
Yeah.
I'm talking about that kind of magnitude of error.
Sure.
You know, the 10 miles, not the hundreds of miles over the, you know, 1,700 miles. So the reason I don't think Buka has decided is because the Itasca would not have gotten. That's the only hard data, hard evidence we have are the Itasca radio logs.
Sure.
And there were two, you know, operators, two recordings, you know, there might be a few little small discrepancies, but, you know, they were both on the same page, so to speak, on what was being said and the signal strength. Yeah, certainly in shallow water. I mean, the Pacific Islands are filled with World War II wrecks, you know, that get covered in coral because they're in hundreds of feet, not thousands. As you mentioned, it's a totally different environment in 17, 18,000 feet of water.
Yeah.
You know, there's not going to meet any marine, certainly the coral. And as Elgin once put it, the airplane sitting down there in 18,000 feet of water, it's going to be like a car that sat in a garage for 20 years. There's going to be a light film of dust on the plane, just, you know, something like that. Things are going to be amazingly well preserved. You know, the paper documents and the instruments, and Paul Allen was finding quite a few World War II wrecks with his research vessel Petrel. The Indianapolis had taken the bomb out to Tinian Island in the Marianas, and then it was sunk shortly after that. You know, the sharks attacking, the crew was in the water for days. That's in about 18,000 feet of water. The ship's number is still visible, 18,000 feet of water. That's the kind of condition we expect the airplane to be in, you know, the N number on the wing.
Yeah.
Still there. Back to Buka, it's going to be in a lot of coral. I don't know. You're going to have to break into that somehow. There should be identifying numbers on that plane somewhere.
Well, we do have engines. And I think for Buka 3, I think the intent is not to... Look, there's no recovering that aircraft, whether it's her aircraft or not. There's no recovering it without seriously damaging the underwater environment there. That's very crucial to the way of life there. So we can't, it's not even something we can get off the ground. But we do have an engine that is separated from the aircraft that we are intending to go after, and we can certainly pull that up. And the goal, I think, is to pull something from within the engine that maybe is in a little bit better condition. We have Pratt & Whitney on board to help us identify parts. And so if we can pull a part from an engine and it happens to match that particular engine, then, you know, then we've got a problem on our hands. And I think, you know, we've got something very serious. And if you look at that, and if you consider, see, what I do is I look at all options. So I'm looking at this as several different playouts. Okay. One, we could all be wrong. And this plane, Abuka, has nothing to do with Earhart, and Tony strikes out, and every deep ocean search strikes out, and it's just not solvable. That's one option, certainly. Two, it's very possible that Tony's got the aircraft. And I am hoping for that personally, because I want to see recovery. I want to see finality. I want to see all of those artifacts, all the things we've been talking about tonight. I want those in the Smithsonian or somewhere where everybody can see that. I don't want it to be at Buka for the sake of that reason alone, because this is a very horrific crash site at Buka. But the other option is that Tony strikes out, and this thing at Buka, we pull the engine out of the water and we pull a piece of copper out of the engine, and a part number happens to match, you know, her engine, and it just takes another step closer to this being something very weird here. I'm looking at all of it. I'm looking at all of it as one giant push. If Tony finds it, then the chase stops, at least in that regard. And I think, hey, that would be fantastic. But if Tony strikes out, then, you know, we're going to Buka one way or another, because somebody died in this aircraft and we're going to find out who. So we're going to have finality one way or another. And I think all of that is good for the case, because either you eliminate Buka and then you push that off the table and then you can focus more on other things, or you have to be forced to include it when it just becomes too big to ignore. Personally, I think we're getting to that point. Personal opinion, but I think it's all good for the case.
Yeah. No, I bring it to a conclusion. You're not waiting on Tony, are you?
No, we go. We're working on trying to get the funding, and we have a team in place. Again, a lot of cross theory involvement in this. It's a historic investigation into the site of Buka when you consider everybody that's involved and everybody that's willing to throw their hat into the ring and to help out. I think it's beautiful for the case, and I think we push forward. So no, we certainly intend to go. If Deep Sea Vision gets out again and they get some of that photography on that, you know, on that wreck site and it's Earhart's aircraft, I can't tell you how happy I'll be. I'll be the happiest guy in the room. But if not, yeah, we push forward. Absolutely. We are in this until it's over, one way or another. Like I've said so many times, I don't care who's right. I don't. I just want it to end. I want the legacy to be what's shined, not the disappearance side of things. And I think we're close. We're closer than ever.
Well, I think a lot of people want to see this come to a conclusion, for sure.
I'm sure you do. I mean, you've been doing this for so long. I mean, it's tiring after all of this time and effort. You probably just, for the love of God, let's just finish this.
Yeah.
So I love that you're always willing to come on and talk with me and, you know, and educate our audience, because, you know, the audience needs to hear from people of your stature. Otherwise, it's just me rambling on and it's, you know, nobody wants to listen to that all the time. So like, thank you for coming on. I mean, I really appreciate you, and we will stay in touch. We will keep this going.
Yeah. Chris,
yeah.
Absolutely. Looking forward to your book when you get it done.
Very soon. We're close to wrapping the second edition now. It's going to be even, you'll be able to beat someone to death with this thing when you're done with it. It's like a brick.
Perfect. Okay.
I will send you one, and we'll talk soon, sir. I appreciate you.
Thank you. Take care.
This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Chasing Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each new episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/ChasingEarhart, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @ChasingEarhart. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to Apple Podcasts to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your editor and host for Chasing Earhart is me, Chris Williamson. The show is produced by my wife, Vanessa Williamson, with music by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Madhouse Films Incorporated. Madhouse Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in the podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Chasing Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Madhouse Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Madhouse Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Chasing Earhart is a Madhouse Films production. All rights reserved.